Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. In this edition of Radio Curious, our guest is Dan Hamburg, a longtime political activist, a former member of the Mendocino County, California Board of Supervisors, and a former member of the United States House of Representatives, representing the North Coast of California. In this conversation, recorded in the studios of Radio Curious on February 26th, 2008, we discussed the concept of rule by fear or rule by law, and what rules at the national, executive, and legislative levels, as well as the local level. We began our conversation with Dan Hamburg when I asked him to describe his childhood connection to politics.
Well, I think to some extent it's a case of born and bred in the Briar Patch. I was raised in a political family. My parents were precinct workers for Adlai Stevenson back in the 50s. I still remember the political paraphernalia on the dining room table and the lists of names and the meetings. And I mean, my parents were really, they weren't lefties or anything. I actually had an uncle who was a well-known lefty in St. Louis, ran a bookstore that was actually attacked by so-called Nazis in St. Louis. This was during the time I was growing up. But my parents were just kind of typical liberal Democrats. I remember my dad used to call Dwight Eisenhower old bubblehead. And they were always very solid Democrats, and for good reason. I mean, it had to do with the kind of work my father did and the family business. And, you know, they basically saw Democrats as the party of small business and the party of social justice. So I started participating in politics at a very young age and really never stopped.
I'd like to talk about national issues and local issues. So let's start with national issues, and particularly an article that you wrote along with Lewis Seiler that was printed in the San Francisco Chronicle on February 4th of this year, entitled Rule by Fear or Rule by Law. Your article makes some allegations about the National Defense Authorization Act that gives the executive, the president, the power to invoke martial law. And you go on to say that for the first time in more than a century, the president is now authorized to use the military in response to a natural disaster, a disease outbreak, a terrorist attack, or any other condition in which the president determines that domestic violence has occurred to the extent that state officials cannot maintain public order.
Yes. The most amazing thing about this article was that it was printed. People can find information about the enormous powers that the executive has taken onto himself during the years, particularly the years since 9/11.
And you're talking about George W. Bush.
I'm talking about Bush-Cheney and the theory of the unitary executive that was originally pushed by John Yoo when he was a professor at Bolt Hall at Berkeley. And just this whole idea that in a time of so-called war or national emergency, that the executive can basically become a law unto himself. And, of course, that harkens back to Richard Nixon, who said, you know, in the famous interview with David Frost, if the president does it, then it's, you know, ipso facto legal. We've had problems in this country for many years and under many presidents with the usurpation of power by the executive. But under George Bush, of course, it's gone to a level that people, I think, hardly could have imagined before the events of the last 7 years. But what was really amazing about this article was that the Chronicle printed it. All this information is available. If you go to the internet, Google in detention camps, martial law, posse comitatus, any of these subjects around the executive absorbing the powers of the other branches of government, and you'll find tremendous amounts of information. But the fact that the Chronicle, which is a mainstream newspaper, was willing to print this information was pretty remarkable. And I think the reason was that we had a connection to the editorial page editor. She'd seen our work before. The piece was heavily footnoted, and the Chronicle decided to print it. And after they printed it, the piece began to be picked up on the internet, and it just took off almost like a virus. And I think if you go to Google now, you'll find over 35,000 hits on this particular article.
Well, let's talk about some specifics. Specifically, Jane Harman, a member of Congress from the Los Angeles area, introduced Violent Radicalization and Homegrown Terrorist Prevention Act of 2007. It was adopted by the House of Representatives 404-6. What's that all about?
Well, that really shows the level of herd mentality that exists in Congress today. I mean, I would bet that most of those 404 members who voted with Representative Harman on that bill didn't really know what they were voting for, but they knew it was something and it had to do with terrorism, and they know they're against terrorism, so they lined up and voted for it. And basically what this bill does is it appoints a commission that is empowered to conduct hearings around the country in which they try to ferret out examples of terrorism or so-called terrorism in communities around the country. The way the bill is set up, not only is there a commission that can hold these, but each individual member of the commission becomes like a little Joe McCarthy that is empowered to go in and do hearings. Like, they could come right to Ukiah, you know, and they could decide, you know, who in Ukiah is a terrorist. Well, certainly anybody growing marijuana could be considered a terrorist. Anybody who's a part of a animal rights group could be considered a terrorist. You know, I do blame it on Bush and Cheney and the neocons that they have introduced a new aspect of fear into the public discourse.
Well, let's back up and handle two things here. Some of our listeners may not be aware of the reference to Joe McCarthy. You want to describe that? I remember him from when I was about 10 years old.
Joe McCarthy was a Wisconsin senator who, in the years when the Cold War was first budding, decided that there was a communist conspiracy that had infiltrated itself into the United States government. And then Senator McCarthy set out to ferret out those elements within the government that he said were conspiring from the inside to overthrow the government.
Similar to what some people think terrorists do now.
Right, right. And you know, Harman's bill, you know, ostensibly is aimed at, you know, stopping this homegrown, so-called homegrown terrorism before it can attack.
Let's talk about the commission and the members of the commission. What authorities would they have if this bill is adopted?
You know, I don't know exactly what authority is, but I know they do have the power to subpoena witnesses and have them testify under oath. And the idea behind this bill is they would use the information they gain in these hearings around the country to draft legislation and, you know, create ways to control this so-called homegrown terrorism. And, you know, as you mentioned, the bill passed overwhelmingly in the House, and now it's gone to the Senate, where Senator Susan Collins, who's a senator from Maine, happens to be the chair of the so-called Homeland Security Committee in the U.S. Senate. And now she's picked it up and, you know, kind of they're trying to jam it through the Senate. But interestingly, the public has picked up on this and decided it's really not such a cool idea. And Susan Collins's offices in Maine were hit with large demonstrations over the past couple of weeks, reminding the senator that a lot of her constituents, at least in the state of Maine, think this is a pretty outrageous idea.
Where in the population of the United States, the will of the people, do you see that this is being allowed, these kinds of singular authorities in the president or agency authorities in this kind of commission, being adopted by Congress overwhelmingly, and the general populace is not standing up to it?
Well, I think that the American populace, by and large, is dumbed down. I remember that great line in Michael Moore's latest movie, Sicko, in which he's over in France, and he's asking a Frenchman, why is it that the French have national health insurance and the Americans don't? And the Frenchman looks at Michael Moore and says, well, in France, the government is afraid of the people. In your country, the people are afraid of the government. And I think people in this country do not get very good educations. They don't think politically. They don't think historically. It reminds me of a saying Bruce Anderson used to use that I liked. He used to, in his criticism of Mendocino County, he'd say, in Mendocino County, every day is the first day of the world. And that was his way of saying that people lack historical understanding or historical perspective. And I think that's really true of the general population in the United States. And I think there's a reason for that. George Carlin, who's one of my favorite all-time thinkers and comedians, does this excellent riff, and you can look it up and watch it on YouTube, in which he talks about the American educational system. And he points out that it's not an accident that the American educational system is one of the poorest in the world in terms of so-called developing nations. It's that way because the government and the powers that be, the financial elites and the political elites, don't want people to ask questions, don't want people to organize themselves so that they could decide for themselves what kind of country they want to live in. You know, for all the consternation about Ralph Nader running for president again, I can understand why he's doing it, because none of the remaining three candidates are going to do anything to challenge corporate rule. And I think a lot of Americans don't even understand the fact that corporations determine virtually everything about the way they live their lives. And that's a political consciousness without which people don't organize to change the society and change their lives.
Well, let's talk about that, how corporations make those decisions. But before we get there, in this interview on Radio Curious, we're talking with Dan Hamburg, who lives and works in Ukiah, is the executive director of Voice of the Environment Incorporated, and a former member of Congress representing the 1st Congressional District in California. You're listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Dan, that's a sweeping allegation. I'm not sure I disagree with you on it, about a corporate determination of how we live our lives. Share with us your thoughts.
Well, everything we do is basically being ruled by corporate interests and the corporate need to maximize profit in everything they do. I remember when I first realized this was many years ago, 20 or 30 years ago, when I was, I used to sit down like everybody does once a month and write out my checks, pay your bills. And when I'd go down to the post office with my bills, I'd look and I'd see what the names were on my envelopes and where the money was going to that was, providing virtually, everything for my life. And it was all going outside the community and all going to corporations. In this country, we've had a major consolidation of economic forces. I think that's why what's going on now in our community here is a drive toward localization, local sustainability, buying local, having a local consciousness about the way we conduct our lives, rather than thinking that, Exxon and Mobil and State Farm and McDonald's. I saw something recently that was done by a satirical group that did the entire American flag, and they had the stars and stripes, but instead of the 50 stars, they had a corporate logo for each star. And it's just a good way to look at what has really happened in our country over the past 200 years. And it's exactly, interestingly, when you look back to the documents of the founding fathers of this country, it's exactly what they warned us against, was the consolidation of economic power and eventually the joining of corporate power with governmental power. So now you've got things like the President of the United States trying to force the Congress to pass a bill immunizing the major telecom corporations for crimes they haven't even been accused of. You know, some people say that's the definition of fascism, when corporations and government are in lockstep. And I think we're very close to that in this country.
You make reference to the local community. Do you see changes in our local Board of Supervisors, the Mendocino County Board of Supervisors, now in relationship to how it was in the early 1980s when you were a member of that board?
Well, I think the board suffers from the same kinds of dysfunction that it did back in the 80s. In some ways, things have gotten steadily worse because government at the local level has become more and more dependent on the transfers of tax money from the state and from the federal government. I went on the Board of Supervisors shortly after Prop 13 passed. And, of course, what that did was it made it it took away the power of Boards of Supervisors to levy property taxes. And that used to be the big event of the year at the Board of Supervisors, was the setting of the property tax, which basically determined what the people of the county, as expressed through the board, thought the level of public services should be. And, you know, that doesn't exist anymore. Now the board has fewer and fewer decisions to make about how money is spent. Most of it is subvented for one particular purpose or another. The few times I do go to the Board of Supervisors and watch their discussions, what really strikes me is how little really respectful and intelligent discussion there is among the board members. And I think it leads to some very questionable decision making.
Can you give us some examples?
One major example that's going on right now is this whole controversy about the DDR project, this mega project for the old Masonite site.
The huge shopping center, right, that would have 3,800 parking places and 28 restaurants, which I believe is more than all the restaurants that now exist in Ukiah.
Yeah, and to see just the amount of misdirection by the board to staff, the amount of wasted time that due to board, I have to say, incompetence around that issue. Just I think that it was about a year ago that the board directed the planning department to do a study of the possibility of putting a moratorium in place until the planning department had been able to catch up with their tremendous backlog of work. And I remember the planning department putting hundreds of hours into doing this study for the board, and then it came back to the Board of Supervisors, and they basically just said, well, we're not interested in that. We're moving on to something else. I think the problem in this county is kind of a microcosm of the problem on the state and federal level, which is that powerful economic interests tend to dominate the discussion of public policy. And there's really no reason that should be the case on the local level. I mean, we should be able to elect members of the Board of Supervisors who certainly have economic interests in their mind and can think clearly about economic issues, but who don't make the profit of individual economic interests in the community the basis upon which they make decisions.
So how is that done? Where do these candidates come from, and how do they present their platform? Directing perhaps your attention to the upcoming election in June of 2008, when three members of the five supervisors will be elected or reelected.
Well, you know, it's tough. There's a few people in our local community, you know, one I'd mentioned specifically, Ron Epstein, who have really been working hard to get a serious campaign finance reform at the city level and at the county level, so that we don't have these supervisors who are elected with a good deal of money coming from outside the county or money coming from particular economic interests. And, you know, I think that would be important to do. But every time such a proposal gets to the board, the incumbents, And this is the same thing that happens at the federal level. Incumbents like the system that got them elected, and they're afraid of a system that might be more democratic because, you know, once you have the power of incumbency, you want to hold on to that power. I think in this particular supervisor race, you do have some candidates emerging that, you know, may be able to put campaigns together. I mean, I remember back in 1979 when I was trying to put a campaign together, it just took a lot of footwork. I walked my my supervisorial district 3 times in a period of 18 months. I mean, I'm not tooting my own horn, but I'm just saying that was, you know, 25 years ago, that's what candidates did. They went out and walked their district. They assembled their friends. They did a huge amount of work that was offered by volunteers. And I don't see that emerging in this current election. I hope it does. I mean, I hope that some of these new candidates like Paula Dieter and Estelle Clifton and Dolly Brown and others can actually put campaigns together in their local communities.
Candidates aside, what advice or specific direction would you give to the Mendocino County Board of Supervisors with the hope that they would follow it?
Not that they would follow it, because the supervisors usually have their own agendas and their own constituents are listening to. But I would say that the main thing they should do is see the needs of the community as a whole and not simply the needs of those constituents with whom they identify. You know, I see that a lot in the, you know, in the votes of Supervisor Wattenberger, who seems to have campaigned on one platform and is now seems to be more aligned with another platform. Specifically, he said when he ran that he was going to resist these kind of large-scale development projects that now he seems to be really waffling on. Supervisor Delbar, I just don't understand what his constituency is, but I think it's definitely thinning out. And you know, and that's why we see a candidacy from another rather conservative player in Carrie Brown. You know, I think it's the same as it's always been with elected officials. You've got to have the big view if you're going to do a responsible job.
Rather than accepting one philosophical point of view over another, are there things that you think, programs or policies that could be instituted that would make the Board of Supervisors more functional and more responsive to the needs of the citizenry?
Well, I don't know if there's any specific programs that I could advocate. I remember when I was on the board, one of the things that Al Beltrami tried to do was get the board members together outside of the boardroom so that we could talk about things like, you know, what were the things we cared about and what were our values and what were the directions that we wanted to take the community so that we could work in some way as a cohesive unit. But you know what, Barry? That isn't something that you can do in a workshop session if people don't really have a commitment to being open about what their values are. Because you're right, the policies that you pursue as an elected official really come down to the values that you hold dear as an individual. And if you can't talk about those values, if you're maybe not even aware of where those values came from, it's very difficult. It's like going into a psychotherapy session and not being able to be self-reflective, not being able to accept information about yourself that you don't particularly like. And I remember that from my own experience on the board with people like Crowfoot and Marilyn Butcher and even Jim Eddy and Norman Duvall, people I liked personally. But, you know, it wasn't very easy to work as a cohesive unit. And I don't see that happening, you know, at all in this board. I see, you know, when I go to the boardroom, I see 5 individuals, you know, 5 very isolated individuals. And I don't see a unified Board of Supervisors who is even willing to talk about what the basis of their decisions is in terms of their values and their vision for where this community might go.
Well, Dan Hamburg, I want to thank you for being with us on Radio Curious. And I have two questions for you. One is, what is the most important thing that you've learned in the past year?
Some of your listeners are going to like this. In the last year, my wife had a very serious bout with cancer. And one of the things that she went through was chemotherapy. And, of course, as part of chemotherapy, patients experience nausea. So we were filled up with every nausea drug, you know, every prescription drug for mild nausea, severe nausea, very severe nausea. You know, our bathroom medicine cabinet just had a cornucopia of pharmaceuticals. But we found that the only thing that really helped her was cannabis. And that was that was a really close-up view for me of the positive effects that cannabis has. It really saved my wife.
The other question is, can you tell us about an interesting book that you've read lately?
Right now I'm reading a series of detective books by a Chinese author, Xu Shaolong. And the book I'm reading right now is called A Loyal Character Dancer. And these books center around a Shanghai inspector named Chen Kao. And anybody who likes reading mysteries would certainly like reading Xu Shaolong's books. And they're available at the Mendocino Book Company.
Dan Hamburg, thanks for being with us on Radio Curious.
My pleasure, Barry.
Dan Hamburg is a longtime political activist, a former member of the Mendocino County, California Board of Supervisors, and a former member of the United States House of Representatives, who represented the North Coast of California. The book he recommends is The Loyal Character Dancer by Xu Shaolong. This interview was recorded in the studios of Radio Curious on February 26, 2008. Copies of this and other editions of Radio Curious can be found on our website, www.radiocurious.org. They're also available in CD format for $10 each. At Radio Curious, we appreciate your thoughts and ideas about our programming and enjoy hearing from you. Our address is Post Office Box 7, Ukiah, that's UKIAH, California, 95482. Our email address is curious@radiocurious.org. And the phone is 707-462-6541. You've been listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Thank you for joining us.